Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
I just want to take the opportunity to welcome everyone who's here in the audience to the LSE this evening, and also everybody who's online. If you're online, you'll have an opportunity to ask questions just like the people who are here in person. And my colleague Nikita is sitting in the front row waiting to hear from you. I'm Grace Lorden, by the way. I'm an associate professor here at the London School of Economics. I'm also somebody, if I did this event last year that was titled What's Funny About Everyday Sexism, I would have just told you the answer is nothing and you all would have went home. But since then, I've met the fantastic Callie Beaton, who I know you all want to hear from tonight. Callie will come on stage and she's going to talk for about 15, 20 minutes and then we'll have time for a Q&A. If you don't know who Callie Beaton is, you're in for a treat. She is an amazing woman, so it's a great representation of LSE this International Women's Day. She's a multifaceted professional, keynote speaker, comedian, business leader, podcaster and writer. I'm not sure she ever gets to sleep, to be honest. She has a rich background in senior roles at major media firms, including Nickelodeon, Viacom, MTV, Comedy Central, and Paramount. She has a podcast that's called Namaste Mother, I'm going to say Fluffers, if you want to look that up. And you can also find lots about her on her website or on Instagram. And she's been now she's a regular presence on mainstream media like Comedy Central, BBC, and Channel 4. Please join me in welcoming Callie Beaton to the LSE.
Oh, thank you so much, Grace. What a generous introduction. It was generous because I wrote it. So, but this is lovely, isn't it? In my life, I have had the pleasure of dancing till dawn with Beyoncé. I've had dinner with Idris Elba. I have milked a camel with Bear Grylls. But never in my wildest dreams did I think I would be here at the LSE on one of your public event initiatives. So this is my first message. Dream big, guys. This is how your career can go too.
So I have a whole load of questions to ask, and I am going to get to the audience, but I have a question that came up when you were talking about quotas. So you mentioned the quotas on panels for shows on the BBC and other UK stations. And I'm wondering what you say to people who say, we don't need quotas because people with merit will rise to the top.
I'm sure you're all aware of, we know a lot about the sort of glass ceiling and how that affects lots of different demographics, but obviously here we're talking about sexism and how it affects us in that regard. But I'm really interested by the idea of the broken rung as opposed to the glass ceiling. So what happens lower down the ladder? And what is it that stops it? So in business, the statistics now, and again, you're better on all of this than me, but there's an overwhelming majority of men who are getting the promotions from entry level to the sort of manager level as opposed to women, which then means that women find it very hard to ever catch up, which then means the pool of candidates doesn't have as many women in at the top as men, so then the people going for the directorships and the board level positions aren't as many women. So somehow we have to play catch up. So it isn't about the number of people I hear on the circuit and they're like, oh, I'm a sort of white guy, I guess I've got no, there's no place for me now. It's like, well, it's not that there's no place for you, but somehow we have to create an environment where we are re-educating people so they find it. If I'm the only woman on a comedy bill or the only woman on a panel show and I mess it up, there is a really good chance, and this has happened to me, that people will be like, yeah, I knew women weren't funny. If a guy messes up a gig or messes up a panel show, the takeout isn't, oh, it's a shame guys aren't funny. So somehow when you're there, you're trying to be funny for all women and liked for all women. So I think a lot has been done to address the balance, but there is a need sometimes to give it a kickstart. So when it's not patronising, it's not trying to do something that penalises people who might have always had some privilege, but we do somehow have to address the balance and it can't always be done in a gradual, gentle way.
I think what's interesting about your trajectory as well, Callie, is that you made it big in an industry where the odds were stacked against you, very high shares of men, and then you managed to do it again. So can you talk about the commonality of the challenges that were in both industries? And maybe there's some differences as well that you faced.
The biggest thing I would say, and I probably don't need to say it to people in this room, I suspect this is something most people here will be really good at, but it's, we say in television about making the edits, and what I mean by that is when I used to be producing TV shows and people would be guesting on the TV shows, the main thing is that you say enough that you get into the edit. So the first time I did an episode of QI, which is a kind of intimidating, you know, panel show, people are very quick on it. The advice I was given was just say enough to make it into the edit. Just don't worry if you're the funniest person in the room. Get your voice into the room and say stuff. Don't wait for it to be perfect. Dive in and say stuff. And it's so important that, again, you'll know more about the research on this than me, but women sometimes will wait to be have the perfect thing to say before they'll say anything. You know, the same statistics about how long women wait to get a job. You know, they wait to apply for a job till they've got all the qualifications. Men will often apply for the job when they have far less of those qualifications. These are generalizations, but they're based on real facts, as you know. So one of the biggest things is daring to have a voice at the table and getting your voice heard and not thinking you need to say something better than the people around you or have it perfectly formed. So I think making yourself be in the room. I think the sort of levels of... I felt like my corporate career, it oscillated between... It was very male-dominated when I first started out. I think there was a sort of period when it felt like it got better. And ironically, when I left my last boardroom position, which was 4 years ago now, I was again the only woman on the board. But it just happened that way. People had left, new people had were made. So I was like, how can this be that in a 20-plus year board level career, I've been the only woman at the start and the end. That's not good. I think the comedy industry has its own sexisms, but equally there is an element of meritocracy in comedy because if you're not good enough, you don't get booked because no one can afford to have a weak link on the bill. And I am aware that because there are less women in comedy than men, as a woman who's got an okay reputation at it, I'm in no shortage of bookings. So I wouldn't say it's particularly holding me back as a comedian. I feel like possibly I'm in a fairly, you know, older and female. There aren't loads of me on any comedy bill. I don't know if it hurts me, I would say, in the live circuit. Yeah.
So what's different about the bookers for the live comedy that it seems to be more of a meritocracy versus the bookers for the TV shows, for the big channels, that it seems to be that it's hard to see diversity on the panels without quotas?
I think it has changed a lot. I think now you do see, now the criticism is where you see such diversity. I'm not saying this is my opinion, but what you hear is, oh, there's such diversity, the quality's gone. So I think that's what's leveled now at TV commissioners. I think there's nowhere to hide in live comedy. Like, if you're up there doing live comedy, there's no edit. It's there, right there in the room. And most bookers don't want to take a risk that somebody's going to sort of stink the room out for 20 minutes. What I would say is, even though now I find it quite easy to get booked as a comedian, I possibly had to pedal harder to get to that point. But once I was starting to get the opportunities and people saw me and knew me, then I kept getting them. I would say that people... I mean, one thing that happens to me a lot is people, when I get to venues, don't think I'm an act. And I have to really argy-bargy with the door people. And I say, no, I'm on stage. And they'll be like, I did tour support for Mickey Flanagan, turned up at the Leicester Square Theatre, went to the front door, there was a big queue of people to get in, said to the person on the door, I'm Mickey's tour support. I was the only other act on stage. It wasn't like there were 30 people going to be on stage. And the security guard was like, no, there's no one else listed. I said, well, I am his tour support. And she made me go to the back of this enormous queue of people, all of whom were going to see me on stage in a minute. And it just looked, it's such a sort of low status moment. And I had to call Mickey's manager and say they weren't. And I did say, as I went into the security guard, I said, if there is a big business in menopausal women trying to bust into comedy venues for free by pretending they're the tour support, let them in. I think it's very it's very creative. So that does happen to me, that I get, and similarly with after dinner speaking, where people assume I'm not the after dinner speaker. Very rarely does anyone stop to notice I'm the after dinner speaker until I've been on. They'll assume I'm someone's plus one or I'm a event manager. I definitely notice the prejudices there. Yeah.
And how do you brace yourself for that before you turn up at the event, knowing that's going to happen?
Well, one of the things that's a massive privilege is that I'm the one who ends up holding the microphone, so there's something really powerful about knowing, well, actually, whatever you're thinking of me now, I'm going to get a chance to show you. I don't have to explain myself because you'll see what you think of me or what you don't. So that's quite empowering to know that I'm lucky enough to have the voice. And I think it's... I mean, you know, it's irritating. So I don't always. Sometimes it can be quite soul destroying. It can be quite nice if afterwards somebody's revisited their opinion a little bit. I do find it kind of irksome. It's all good content for Instagram, though, when it happens, so, you know, get some stuff out of it.
Because I'm listening to you, and you spoke a lot about imposter syndrome when you were speaking, and I would imagine, and I've had experiences similar to what you're describing, if you show up somewhere and people make you feel like you don't belong, then it's natural to have imposter syndrome, right? It's them rather than you who's causing that emotional reaction.
I think the best advice I've been given about imposter syndrome, so I definitely am not a fearless person. It takes a lot of effort to make things look effortless. Let's be honest about that. So I definitely am not a fearless person. And I don't always have the biggest amount of self-belief. But what I have learned is that turning up to events authentically with how I'm actually feeling is a more powerful way to connect with an audience than pretending to be someone I'm not. Yeah. So I'll always notice how I'm feeling in a given environment and try and bring that quality and really turn up on the stage with what's really going on. And I actually think with imposter syndrome, it's not trying to get rid of it, it's building a relationship with it. I don't think if it holds us back, that's a difficult thing. But if we can find a way to work with it, not against it,
yep.
I think sometimes it's what also makes us better at what we do. There's an element of self-awareness and humility in it. I haven't rid myself of it by any means.
So I mentioned in the start who I am at LSE, but I didn't mention that the Inclusion Initiative is hosting the event tonight. And given that, I'm interested in what you think comedy can do to help break down barriers to diversity and inclusion here in the UK and maybe even globally.
One of the things I think is really lovely about comedy is you really do get to dig into your own voice and your own opinions and say things your way. That is why we sometimes get people who are cancelled, because they say things their way and the world has moved on and finds that offensive. My comment to anyone, sometimes I get comics who I work with who are like, oh, it's woke gone mad, you can't say anything nowadays. And I always say, what is it you want to say then? What is it you want to say that you can't say nowadays? And usually you find anyone who's saying that has something fairly objectionable to say. I don't feel there's anything that I'm not allowed to say that I'd love to say, because I don't have those things whirring around in my head. I think you're able to say more than you've ever been able to say, but society has decided that some of what was being said 5, 10, 20 years ago is not acceptable. That's great. We've voted with our feet. So one of the things I love about stand-up is that it really is a sort of, you know, I present whatever's really going on in my life, whatever my real opinions are. My stuff on stage is fairly sort of feminist, I would say. I don't go out to try and be a feminist comedian, but I certainly talk about the way I see things, and I talk about that. And often I'll have audiences who perhaps don't think the same way as me, and they hear a different perspective. Perhaps they have a view of what a mid-50s woman would be like, and perhaps I'm not it. So then after they've heard me for 20 minutes, maybe they revisit it. And as long as you're funny, people will often go with you. And yeah, I have some really... So I think you get a chance to use it as a... I'm not trying to use it as a platform for good. I'm trying to be funny. But I don't shy away. I did a whole show about my son's autism. My son's now an autistic primate keeper. He was always obsessed with animals, and that's what he does for a living. He's autistic. He's not looking after gorillas with Rubik's cubes. He works with animals, and I did a whole show about him and his autism and what it was like being his mum. And I think that was a really helpful thing. He loved the show. I got lots of... I think it was helpful to have a chance to talk about that and other people who might have that experience. Hopefully... I don't think that there's a sort of... cancel culture that's getting out to sort of set against comedians. I think that audiences are intelligent enough to know what is palatable and what is not. Yeah. And if it's not, quite rightly, that it's they will say so. Yeah.
And the last question before we go to Nikita for the online audience and then for the people in the room, I guess it interested me when you talked about changing your career and that Joan Rivers said something to you and that was the impetus for change. But I'm guessing you knew for a while that you wanted to do something different. So if there's people in the room who are thinking about changing careers, what are the signs that they will be having right now, and what should they do next?
I think a big part of it is, a couple of things. One is, I always said to myself, if I ever was doing a job just for the money, I did need to earn the money. I was the sole breadwinner. I had money had to come in. But if I was just doing a job for the money, it would be time to have a think about that and see what other options might be available. So once I started to think, I think I'm doing this for financial security and not so much else now, that was a time to have a conversation. And I think it's basic motivational theory is when you think about it's really easy to not like something and go, I just want to get away from that. I don't like my course, I don't like my partner, I don't like my job, whatever it is, I need to get out. That will take you in a certain direction of travel, but as we all know, deciding what you're trying to move towards gives you a whole different momentum. So if you try and think, what would I like my career, my job, my study, my relationship, what would I like it to be like if I could, if it was possible, allow yourself to put flesh on the bones of that and then see what of that might be possible without limiting yourself by going, well, there's no point even thinking about that, it can't be mine. So the idea of moving towards something compelling. And it took me a while to work that out with my boardroom job and to think, well, what would I like my life to be like? That's when I came up with the idea of doing sort of TED Talky, keynote speaking type things. It hadn't occurred to me, take the skills I have from corporate life with me, combine them with comedy. I don't have to start from scratch. You know, the podcast is not starting from scratch. It's bringing everything to the table. And also, I think to have ambition in change, you don't have to downsize with change or compromise. You can take everything you are to date and bring it into the next thing and make that even bigger. You don't have to delete what you were before. Bring it all with you and see what bits of it are transferable. It's usually more than you think.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Kelly. So we'll start with Nikita. For people in the room, I'm going to gather up a few questions. If you could have short questions so I can gather three together, that would be really helpful. Nikita, what's happening online?
So we have an anonymous user asking that recently they were told that feeling belonged or not could be a personal decision and feeling and does not necessarily mean the environment is not inclusive. And it was told to them by a person who was a minority in a group and did not feel belong. They felt that they did not feel belong because of her. And they put in a lot of efforts to make themselves feel belonged and make a lot of connections. So they would like to hear your thoughts about that. Is it a personal feeling or is it because the group is not exclusive?
So what was the, I think I missed the sort of headline of what the question was.
So there's a person who feels like they don't belong within the group. They've made efforts to try to go into the group, but that hasn't worked out for them. And they're wondering, is it them or is it the people who are around them?
I think it's really, there are rights and wrongs sometimes in group behaviour for sure, because you sometimes have bullying and really unacceptable things. But all you can ever do in a situation is whatever's within your gift to do. Whether you like it or you don't like it, that is usually the only thing you can control. So the only thing you can do is try and think, what could I do that would help me? And I'm a big believer, this may sound odd when you're at the sort of student level in your life, but metaphorically, the idea that everybody needs their own personal boardroom, you need allies and cheerleaders around you. And some people will have that sort of inherently within their world because they have a lot of privilege and they will have a lot of sponsorship in life. By sponsorship, I mean traction to help them through their careers and their lives. And some people won't have so much of that. So wherever you are on that continuum, sitting here, you know, watching the live stream or here with us physically, to think where you are on that spectrum. So if I was somebody not feeling that I was included and not feeling there's that connection, I would find that really hard to fight on my own. I would think, well, who might be able to be an ally? Who might I be able to look for to build that own personal boardroom of people who'll help me through that? And if you're in the room thinking, I've never felt that I don't belong, I've never felt I'm not connected, but that's brilliant. So then what are you going to do to bring some people with you? Because there are people who could really benefit from your position as well. So we have to check our privilege on that continuum. So I would definitely be looking for allies and support.
And I think at the extreme, leave the room, find other people who you surround yourself with. Right?
Yeah, another thing, I mean, I've never felt I belong. It's one of the things that fundamentally drives me, I think, and makes me quite unhappy sometimes. I've never felt I belong, and comedians often say that. We often end up being comedians because it's the first place any of us have felt we belong. And we're see us all in a green room. We haven't got much in common, but we tend to have in common the fact we don't belong. So I still have a conviction that I absolutely don't belong. So I very much relate to that person's feeling. Yeah.
Fantastic. So in the room, so I have 1, 2, 3 hands in a row here, and then we'll go to the other side. Yes.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can.
Hello, everyone. My name is Francesca. And so basically, I have a question, Kelly, for you regarding what sort of a business environment. So I work in the transport industry, and often I am the only woman in the boardroom. And very often, just because, you know, I want to be respectful to other people, so I won't turn up in jeans, you know, I would be, you know, wearing a formal but nice outfit. I'm often looked as the pretty thing in the room and not often listened to for what I'm doing, for what I'm saying, which I feel is something of value. So I wanted to know, how did you deal with that throughout your career? And yes, how also you turned down some maybe comments that were a bit sexist?
Yeah, it's such a hard question, isn't it? Because now it's easier for me to say whatever I want because I don't have a boss, so no one can fire me anymore. I think, well, there's a couple of things. I think, and again, this is why microaggressions are so incredibly dangerous, right? Because then we do what's called self-shielding, you know, and we sort of hide ourselves because we're so, because we get so sick of the, you know, the, as we know, they're not called microaggressions because they're tiny and they don't matter. They matter. So whether it's microaggressions or moreover discrimination, it's incredibly soul-destroying, first of all. And I don't have, I mean, I left the ITV boardroom because I was so unhappy. So I didn't solve anything apart from I left. What I did try and do then when I was in boardrooms subsequently was create cultures so at least the people my level and down had a better experience. So I did a huge amount to try and influence the culture that I could control below me to be something where people were coming up through the ranks having a better experience than I'd had. And I think it is also calling it out with allies again, thinking who can I talk to about this, whether it's literally HR or learning and development or whoever, or whether it's somebody more, you know, who could be an, because I mean, male allies are really powerful. Some of the best allies I've ever had in my working life have been men. It isn't just that we have to surround ourselves by empowered women. But it is, I mean, one of the things that, and there's been lots written about this, is women getting told they're aggressive. When actually the behaviour, I remember one of my last bosses I ever had in corporate life said to me, you're very aggressive. And I asked an example. I said, oh, can I understand what you mean by that? And he gave me an example of a deal I'd done, a multi-million dollar deal, I might add. And someone else in the business, a man, had done a very similar deal in a very similar way and had been promoted. And I said, can I just clarify, what is it that he did then that got him that promotion that is different? And then I ended up getting an apology and being told it was a misunderstanding. And there's been research about language used in technology in Silicon Valley, women getting told they're too aggressive, men getting told they're too soft. So somehow it's so hard that we have to call it out, but it's quite hard to call it out without people around you to support. And also just to make a note of what is said, like the facts. It's not your opinion. If someone comments on your looks or indicates you're there because you're a pretty little thing, that is completely unacceptable and needs to be written down so that you can then challenge it. I mean, you shouldn't have to, but you shouldn't equally have to sit and accept that. So yeah, and I'm sorry you go through that. I mean, that's a really tough thing to be going through day in, day out. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Raising your voice and also what you do for others who so they'd have to go through it. But it's tough. It's really tough. I'm not trying to talk it right or simplify it. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
There's the woman here. Yes.
Yeah, hi. Firstly, thank you. I really enjoyed what you spoke about, especially making the edit. I'd be really interested in hearing your opinion as a comedian, what you say to other comedians who say that a racist or sexist joke is part of the act, and they compare it to how an actor saying a joke wouldn't that joke wouldn't represent them. And what you think of that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes loads of sense. It's really very timely you said that actually, because I was on the bill. I do a lot of emceeing, less now, but I get booked a lot to host nights. I don't curate them. I literally am just the host who gets paid. And a club I did a few nights ago is owned by someone who was a very famous comedian a few decades ago and is now probably, you probably wouldn't know who they were, but people my age would know who they are. And because it's his club, he has a habit of just turning up and asking to do material. So the bill that was there, it's a bit of a blokey club anyway. I'm not always mad on how they do the bills, but the material's fine. But they don't have the most inclusive booking policy. Anyway, the guy turned up and said he wanted to do a spot. And I was like, I know his. Let's just say I don't think his stuff is the most evolved and probably the most appropriate in the world we live in. I was like, okay. So he did, and sure enough, he did two things that I found completely offensive. One was very sexist and one was transphobic. And half the room laughed and half the room booed, which is about what you would expect you would get. And then I had the dilemma of what do I say, because also he owns the club and we're about to be backstage right after this in a room the size of a small wardrobe together. So what I did was I went on stage after him, and by then I'd brought quite a few acts on and off, and I just didn't say anything about him. Everyone else, I said, oh, give it up for whoever, and wasn't that fun? I just didn't acknowledge him. I just said, we're going to have a break now. If you would take your glasses to the bar, and we've got a really brilliant act coming up. And that's all I said, and I suspect people would have noticed a difference. And at the end of the night, I said, by which time he'd gone, I said, hope you've all enjoyed it. I said, we don't always have quite such a diverse array of views represented on the stage, and I hope you'll forgive us and still come back. And I then decided afterwards I'm never playing that club again, and I've told the promoter why. So, but I still don't feel I probably did enough. I spoke to my son and a couple of other people afterwards and said I think I bailed it a bit, but I don't know what else I should have done. But I do know, at least I knew that was unacceptable in that moment, and it's hard. It's hard to call it out. And in green rooms, it's hard. I have things said in green rooms sometimes that are completely offensive, and I do call them out, and it feels really frightening, actually, because you're in a small environment with people who can impact on your career. It's really difficult to do it, yeah.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hi, sorry. Thank you, first of all, for the talk. I'm Teresa, and my question relates a little bit to the topic, to the title of today's event, because I think comedy can be a great leverage for pointing out sexist behavior, and can also be a clever way, because then people might not perceive you as aggressive or might not see you as the political correct person who's always there telling you what to do, not what not to do. So my question would be, how do you leverage comedy, or maybe you have some specific situations or examples that we can also take away in our daily lives? Thank you.
Well, the biggest voice you ever have is, as we know, social media. So the only way I'm ever going to reach millions of people is something I do on social media. The stuff I do on TV very rarely reaches as many people as the stuff I do, the ones that do well on social media. And I will put things out that are completely in my voice, my way, saying it how I want to say it. You know, someone came up to me, I'm trying to think whether I can say everything I did in the reel without, yeah, I think I can, without offending anyone or being using language I'm not allowed to use. But someone came up to me, I talk about menopause on stage in my, not exclusively, but I'll often mention it as a 55-year-old woman. And a guy came up to me after a gig recently, this really happened, really nice guy. And then he said, but what about people like my grandmother and my mother? My grandmother and my mum, they just got on with the menopause. They didn't need to bang on about it all the time. So I then did a reel saying, and this is what I said to him, but I did a reel about it. And I said, well, how do you know they just got on with it when women were being given Valium and locked up in institutions and given hysterectomies? And I said, I think if men had been having, you know, their willies calf because they had, you know, mood swings and they couldn't regulate their own temperatures, we'd all agree it's great. It's on the agenda nowadays. So, and I put a reel out along those lines and it got millions of views and loads of women saying, you know, thank you for saying that. So I think it was like a funny, a sort of humorous take on a thing that could be quite irritating. So, yeah, it's, and I, same in my podcast, I get to say it sort of my way and, yeah, and it is also, it's quite good to invite the debate as well, you know. So lots of the people I engage with and support me are, not all my followers are women, you know. More are women than men, but it's a broad, you know, you get a chance to have a platform to people across ages, across gender, across a diverse group of people can hear you if they are willing to.
Amazing. So let's go to this side of the room to see if there's any questions. Yes, we have one. Amazing.
Hi, thank you. I have a question basically about organizational measures. So you already said that you unfortunately had left this board that you were referring to because you were feeling really not good. Do you have any ideas of extra organizational measures beyond quota that might have helped you to stay on a board or to basically be able to also change things in organizations that also might have helped you and that would maybe even have allowed you to also better help others, because you also said you tried to help others, but you also had limited control. I wanted to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think changing company culture is the hardest thing. Like, leading a company is easy compared to changing the culture. That's like turning a tanker, and it needs to come from within. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that companies make is they say, well, how can we learn more about what women want? Or how can we learn more about what this demographic want? It's like, well, why don't you give them a voice then and talk to them? Why don't you stop patronizing them and let them have a voice? So we used to do a thing, for example, called reverse mentoring when I was at Viacom, because the brands that we had, you know, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, MTV, young brands. And by the time I was in a boardroom, I was in my 40s, I was not the viewing demographic. So we would have people who were of the viewing demographic age, or as close as we could get. By virtue of that, they were new entrants to the company. They might have been at a very sort of junior level, not very experienced, and they would have a seat on the program development board, not a token seat, an actual seat, to help decide on the content decisions. And then we would obviously monetize them. But they had the time I knew reverse mentoring was working was when we dropped the word reverse. It was just mentoring, because mentoring is reciprocal. So I think any of those kind of initiatives, or whatever people now call them, but employee resource groups, we used to call them employee resource groups. This is going back 15, 20 years now, but that was one of the things I first set up at Viacom. We started with one that was for parents in the company. We moved across a big range of different voices that weren't represented. And we would have executive champions who they weren't at the top of those resource groups, but they were the people who would try and unlock funding and policy. But the people who ran those groups were not the people in boardrooms. They were the people who needed the voice, who felt passionately about the thing. So really all the senior people should be at that point as a gatekeeper and an enabler, and the voice should be allowed to come up. So really the only way you can change things, because you don't know what you don't know. And the real problem with those boardrooms is if you recruit and network in your own image, the whole is never greater than the sum of the parts, because all the parts are the same. So somehow we have to walk towards difference and allow difference to come through the ranks and be open to hearing about that. I think a lot of what goes wrong on social media is when people pronounce things that are really offensive. It's not because they're trying to be offensive, it's just they have no idea and they're not willing to ask somebody, and then offensive things get said. And somehow we have to sort of educate. It doesn't mean things don't get said that are offensive and need to get shut down, but letting multiple voices be heard, I think, is the only way to achieve a cultural change.
Amazing. So this side of the room, do we have any questions? Yes, please.
Hi, thank you. I have a question, because you worked in the media industry a long time and still as a comedian now, and I having like a stage. And I'm always quite curious about how the media, how movies, books, podcasts, all of these kind of things actually also have their take in reproducing everyday sexism. Like, if we watch a movie and we see the family life, right? And then it's always the mother doing all the care work, and it's very little the man, I don't know, picking up the child from school or cooking or like doing any kind of care work. And I was just wondering what your take is on media's responsibility in reproducing everyday sexism, and whether maybe you also have some experience from those boardrooms, if it was ever being addressed, if there's like changes happening, maybe people, yeah, trying to do something.
Yeah, it's a great question. And when I do longer speeches, I have some slides about the statistics, particularly in the film and TV industry, about women on screen, women off screen. The numbers are all going in the right direction, but incredibly slowly. Do you know what the Bechdel test is? So yes, and 50% of movies in the last year passed that test. That's still shockingly shocking, because 50 didn't, but there wouldn't have been as many as 50% even 2 years ago. Similarly, the number of movies directed by women, composers, it's still tiny, like 9%, I think, of movies last year had female composers. So there's still much more that needs to be done. I think one of the things that's helping, I don't know if you, one of the films that got nominated and the lead actor won in it, How to Have Sex, and the director of that movie, the cast, those kind of movies, Barbie, obviously different sort of league of women who were very much more known, directing, starring. But I think while there are those kind of things happening, it shines a light on it, but those things still don't always get rewarded. If you look at who wins the awards, they might get as far as doing something outstanding and getting nominated it's about people then, when you've got quite traditional people voting, allowing those things still to come through. So it's an incredibly slow process, but I do think many editorial staff and commissioners and funders are aware of the need for change. It takes a very long time for it to come into play. It is going in the right direction if you look at the numbers, but my God, it's slow. It's going to take decades at this rate to get where we need to go. So it's a really good question, and I wish I had had a magic wand or had one now. Now I'm at the other end trying to get cast in things. So yeah, same problem.
So Nikita, you have the power for the last question with the online community. What have you chosen?
So sexism as everyday humor can be considered punching down rather than punching up. Is it still popular because people feel empowered when they punch down and it's less risky?
I think one of the things that just isn't really tolerated is among comedians, but in the sort of peer-to-peer is punching down. People sometimes hear a word and think you are punching down. They just hear the words. They hear me talk about having an autistic son and they think, why are you taking the mickey out of autistic kids? That is not what I'm doing. What I'm doing is celebrating my kid, and if anyone is having the mickey taken out of them, it's me. I know exactly what I'm doing and who I'm bringing up and who I'm bringing down. So I don't think punching down is acceptable. There are jokes that are made where people, it's always what is the standpoint of the person making the joke. If you know what they stand for and what their view is, then the words mean different things. So I think it's, and that's not, there are some things that are not able, that should not be said, but sometimes people just hear a word out of context and like, you shouldn't be talking about that, but actually the person might be saying something really useful about that. So the idea is that there's nothing you can't talk about comedically if you do it in the right way. And they also say, comedy plus tragedy plus time equals comedy. So also that some quite dark topics can be talked about, but perhaps not the day they happen. So I think it's all about tone and what is the intent and the view of the person saying it. And punching down should never be tolerated, let alone celebrated, in my opinion, as a comic.
Thank you. So before we thank Callie, just a few things to say. Nikita, thank you so much for helping with the online community. Sasha Gosi, who is wearing orange in the front, is the person behind the scenes who organises the events. So we get to sit here and turn up. She's done amazing organisation. And I also, because it's International Women's Day, want to thank Lucy Lawler, who's here in the audience, who's my mentor and friend, in the spirit of actually encouraging you all to expand your own mentorship. We work in the Inclusion Initiative here at the LSE, and we have a mantra around opportunities, visibility and voice. You mentioned, what do women want differently to men? And I would argue actually men and women want the same thing. They want opportunities, visibility and voice. So if you're sitting here, it's worth thinking about and reflecting, do you get opportunities, visibility and voice in the rooms that you're in your classroom if you're a student here at the LSE, in your workroom if you're out in the workplace? And also look around you and pay attention to other people who are around you and whether they're getting opportunities, visibility and voice. And if you can, in the spirit of International Women's Day, which is now a week, I think, please do advocate for others. But last but not least, Callie, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's been absolutely fantastic to have somebody who has been successful in not one but two careers that are high shares of men to come and share your insights. And I do hope you'll come back to LSE where you now belong.
I will. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.